You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's common for sports fans to boo referees when they don't like a call, but many refs say some fans cross the line. Now there's a bill that would punish those who harass sports officials, especially in youth games. We'll find out more. Now, according to the U.S. Department of Labor, in 2019, about 8,500 employers stole compensation from their workers. Many of those employers are repeat offenders, and low-income workers are most at risk. Our next guest has been digging into the factors behind wage theft and learning why there aren't more consequences for businesses that do it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a victim one way or another of wage theft? Are you aware of your rights and resources? Do you think there needs to be more enforcement? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alexia Fernandez-Campbell is a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. She covers labor and workers' rights. Alexia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
As you point out in your big new report for the Center for Public Integrity, wage theft isn't exactly a legal term, though it's most of the forms of it are against the law. Can you tell us what we mean when we use the phrase wage theft?
Yeah, so wage theft includes some common scenarios that maybe a lot of workers are familiar with. Like, you know, they don't work, we don't pay over. So they'll only pay you for 40 hours, but expect you to work more than 40 hours. You know, there's also bosses who say, you know, we don't pay overtime rates, but we'll pay your same rate. So you work more than 40 hours a week, but you pay that you earn the same amount of money instead of 50% extra. And it's also the people that, you know, end up earning less than the minimum wage. And sometimes employers just don't pay workers at all and, you know, hope that they won't complain or try or sue them.
And what kind of enforcement is there, at least in theory? You focus mostly on the federal level to try to make sure this doesn't happen.
Yeah, so the Department of Labor is in charge of enforcing the law, the federal law, which is the Fair Labor Standards Act. The problem is that they are very underfunded and they don't have a lot of investigators and they don't have a lot of lawyers. So sometimes when they catch employers breaking the law, they'll sometimes demand back wages to repay them, but they won't fine them. They won't, even ones that, you know, companies that repeatedly break the law, they won't get fined. They won't take them to court. So, you know, companies just keep doing this over and over again.
So, and as you write, if I'm an employer and I decide and I make employees, as you say, do some of their work off hours or underpay, pay under the minimum wage, that kind of thing, I know as a company, my main risk is at worst, if I'm caught, I might have to pay that back pay. So some companies apparently are willing to take that risk.
Yeah, because think about it. I mean, if you're a worker and you end up like you steal from your employer, you know, that's going to be a crime. You're going to, you know, if you do it a lot, you go to jail. But, you know, if an employer breaks the law and takes wages from their employees, it's a civil infraction. So the worst that's going to happen is, you know, maybe you pay a fine, like $1,000 fine. Maybe, you know, if they're going really hard, then you might pay like, you know, double the amount that you owe in damages to the employee. But most of the time what we've seen is that, you know, all you have to do is pay the money back. So, you know, it just happens so often that the chances that you don't get caught are pretty high. So, and even if you do get caught, all you have to do is pay the money that you owed. And so that, you know, it doesn't really stop employees. It doesn't give employers a reason to not do it.
And can you tell us a little bit about the scope of the problem? I gave one statistic there. How widespread is wage theft?
Yeah, so I was looking at the data that we got through a Freedom of Information Act request. And, you know, I thought that it would be obvious that there are just like some states where it's higher violations, but it's just like across the board. It doesn't matter if you in the blue state, red state, it's just happening everywhere. Even some states that have high, like really strong wage theft laws. There's still like there are tons of cases. So we're talking about like millions of dollars taken every year from workers just from the violations caught by the Department of Labor, not including others. But, you know, some economists, they say that it's, you know, billions of dollars every year that workers are losing out on. And it's usually the, you know, the lowest paid workers who don't understand the law and aren't aware of the rights or just afraid of losing their jobs if they complain.
Right. You're working a lot with federal data, but as you point out in the piece, and you just mentioned economists think the problem is bigger. the stuff that ends up on federal data is only if a worker realized they've been a victim of wage theft and taken the initiative to file a complaint with the Department of Labor, right? Those are the ones that'll be in those official statistics.
Well, that's true. So for the most part, it's always been complaint driven. So it requires like an employee or a union to file a complaint on behalf of an employee. But the Department of Labor does target some industries and take initiative to go after some employers, and they'll just like do surprise visits. But it's just they just don't have enough investigators. I mean, they really have so few investigators that it happens that they'll give surprise visits or do surprise investigations. It's very rare.
We're talking to Alexia Fernandez-Campbell, senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, looking at a new report she authored on wage theft and a lack of effective enforcement in many ways around the country. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about wage theft and how it works? Have you seen it happen? Has it happened to you at your workplace? And did you know if you had the right to challenge that? Would you know who to complain to? If you work with workers, maybe as an attorney, have you seen this happen here in the state? You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Alexia Fernandez-Campbell. She covers labor for the Center for Public Integrity and has been reporting on the issue of wage theft around the country. People being required to do some of their work for free without clocking in, being paid under minimum wage, not getting overtime when by law they should. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has this happened to you or someone you know at the workplace? Was there a successful legal challenge? Do you think there's enough awareness about wage theft? Employers, what do you know about this issue? What do you watch out for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alexia, in your piece, you write about some of the workers most vulnerable to wage theft, often members of minority groups. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, so we found out that, I quoted some research from some economists, and they've looked at this issue. And looking at surveys from the Census Bureau, they've found that Latino workers in particular are the most vulnerable to getting paid less than the minimum wage. They're like twice as likely as white employees to be paid less than the minimum wage, and black workers are 50% more likely to be paid less than the minimum wage. So it's something that is not surprising in a way, because a lot of the low wage workforce is made up of workers of color. So there's that, but it's also just, you know, because they, you know, many of them didn't maybe graduate from high school and they're in like these low wage jobs, and so a lot of that is how that ends up happening.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hello.
Hi. I'm a stagehand. Right now I work for a union for the last 20 years. But prior to working in the union, I worked at a local big theater here in town in Milwaukee. And they were paying us stagehands maybe $12 to $13 an hour. But through talking to the traveling bands and whatever other shows were at our theater, we found out that the theater was charging the traveling shows as if we were union stagehands. So they were charging $20, $25 to $30 an hour for our labor. They were literally making money off of our labor and not, you know, passing that on to us, and the ticket prices would be the same as at a union theater. And I don't know if that's really wage theft, but it sure sounds shady to me, and it's very common practice for non-union theaters to do this procedure.
Ray, thanks a lot for the call. It does sound kind of shady, Alexia, and maybe it's fraudulent, but if I'm reading your work correctly, it wouldn't necessarily constitute a wage theft.
Yeah, so that's an interesting scenario. I hadn't heard about that before, but what I have seen a lot of is, companies that will subcontract with other companies And they'll say in their contract, you know, this is how much we're going to pay our workers. And I think in some contracts, so it depends. Is it legally binding? I would think so, that if you say you're going to pay your workers this much, that it would be legally binding. But maybe, you know, some of the, whatever contract he's referring to, it might not have been legally binding, saying this is how much we're going to pay the workers. And so, you know, the company just took some of the, you know, shaved off part of the wages and kept the money for themselves.
Ray, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Ted now in northern Wisconsin. Ted, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Ted?
A waiter at a restaurant, and you get credit card tips, and your employer never puts them on your pay stub. The credit card tips just poof, disappear. What can you do about that?
Ted, thanks a lot for the call. And Alexi, I know tipped employees, thinking waiters, wait staff here, are a big part of the wage theft story. What do you say to Ted?
Yeah, Ted, this is such a huge problem, especially in the restaurant industry, because, you know, employers can pay less than the minimum wages law and, you know, make up the rest in tips, let workers make the rest in tips. But yeah, so they're, you know, I don't know how, like by law, how it's supposed to appear in your paycheck, but you're definitely supposed to be getting your tips. The problem is that, you know, under federal law, your boss just has to make sure that you're earning minimum wage under federal law. Now, I don't know, you know, the extra tip that you'd get if it was beyond minimum wage. Some restaurants think that they can keep the extra tips, but, you know, the best thing to do is to, you know, file a complaint with the Department of Labor, or if the state's work for your, you know, Wisconsin's own Department of Labor, that would be my advice.
Thanks a lot for that call. And it gets worse, as I understand it, Alexia, from your reporting. As you said, if that tipped worker, their tips don't bring them up to minimum wage, their employer is supposed to make up the difference. And that, you write, often does not happen, right?
Yeah, because, you know, there are a lot of, you know, restaurant servers, they're rushing around, they're getting cash, but, you know, their boss is supposed to keep track of how much tips they're earning, because they need to make sure that they're earning enough to at least get the minimum wage. And, you know, that just, so many employers will just say, oh, you know, we weren't keeping track, we don't know. But no, they're required to keep track of how much you're making in tips, even if it's cash tips, so that they know that if you're making the minimum wage. What happens is, you know, they're not keeping track, and they just hope that the server will not be keeping track either and will not notice that they're getting less than the minimum wage.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Carrie with us next in Green Bay. Carrie, hello.
Hi. My husband was the sole employee for a detailer in this area, and she never provided him with a pay stub. And when he kept asking to see the pay stub, she said she kept files in her file cabinet, and she would ask him, why do you want to see that? So he never saw anything until the end of the year. And he would ask her, like, why is my pay so low? And she would tell him, oh, it's just taxes. Well, at the end of the year, what he received from her was a Word document that she had typed up and handwritten in numbers that she said her accounting gave him. And we found out he was only paid for 4 full-time weeks out of the entire year. So she was down marking his labor, and there was nothing he could file about it at that point. So he was stolen. He had wage stolen, and he was bullied about asking about it.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call. Is there recourse for somebody in that small company in that situation, Alexia, where it sounds like a duplicitous sort of situation?
Yeah, so under federal law, it depends on how big the company has to make at least $500,000 in revenue to be subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act. But if they are subject to it, if they make that much money, it doesn't matter if they have like only one employee. If they're making that much money, like companies are supposed to keep records of their pay. Like that's just the law. So if this happened within the past 2 years, you still have time to file a complaint with the Department of Labor. If it happened more than 2 years ago, then, you know, the way the law is that you can't try to like get your money back if it's been more than 2 years since it passed. But yeah, that sounds like an absolutely like terrible situation. And unfortunately, that's more common than people realize.
Carrie, thanks a lot for the call. Sorry that happened to your husband. We're talking to Alexia Fernandez-Campbell with the Center for Public Integrity about her recent investigation on wage theft in the United States. Alexia, before we go back to our callers, if somebody, say, in that situation or other wage theft situations, wanted to take their employer to court. I mean, given the amounts of money that are involved, it might be, you know, a few thousand dollars. Is it hard to get even attorneys to take up a case like that?
Yeah, it actually is. One of the things that I've heard from a lot of experts I talk to is that the dollar amounts are so low that a lot of attorneys won't take on these cases unless they're like at least $2,000. But what attorneys find in many cases, and first of all, like the attorneys that handle these cases are called wage and hour attorneys. What they'll do is they'll check to see if the worker was also working more than 40 hours a week, because many times they'll come and say, hey, they didn't pay me for this week of work. And then so the attorney will ask, well, have you also been working more than 40 hours a week and not being paid overtime? And they'll be like, oh, yes, that happens all the time. So then that increases the amount of money owed, and maybe the worker didn't realize that they were also getting, you know, scammed in that way through overtime, not just the pay. So attorneys will try to check to see if there are overtime violations as well, and then they'll be more likely to take on the case. But attorneys will take, from what I've heard, like will take on cases even without charging attorney's fees, because the way the law is, if an employer is found at fault, then the employer will end up paying the attorney's fees. So they'll take on a lot of cases. But yeah, if it's less than $2,000, it's a lot of attorneys won't touch it.
And I should say, I said these were small amounts of money. That's by lawsuit standards. For somebody making a low income, you found, you know, this $1,000 or $2,000 of wage theft could make a big difference.
Yeah, you know, and what we found, like some researchers have shown that, you know, the lowest paid workers in the U.S., like the bottom 15% of income earners make less than the minimum wage. And what they're losing is about like $1.50 per hour, which doesn't sound like a lot for some people, but it is a lot when you're making minimum wage. That's like a huge chunk of your paycheck. So, so this is a big problem, and it makes it harder for people to pay their rent and pay their bills.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jill is with us in Northeast Wisconsin. Jill, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Jill?
Sure. So I just took on a new role in human resources, and I was informed I would be the backup payroll person. And it has been about a month, and it sounds like I'm the point payroll person, actually. And I have noted copious discrepancies within the system, which just seems to be in shambles. I have had so many employees come up to me bringing up discrepancies that have taken place over the course of the year prior to me being there. And as I've learned to go back into the archives and review each weekly pay rate, and they were in fact not paid for those hours or those bonuses. And they are also on the lower end of the income spectrum. The other thing I would say is when we talk about the lower end, a lot of my employees, I've found, they really don't understand how to read their paycheck. And a lot of times it is online now, and they may not have access to that. So that also poses us to a challenge if they would like to bring up an inquiry.
Jill, thanks a lot for that call. Wow, a lot there. Alexia, what do you think of the story Jill has from her new workplace?
Wow, I mean, I can't imagine being in a situation like that where you're handling payroll and then you notice that the workers at the bottom are really getting, like, you know, I guess ripped off or cheated. That's a really terrible situation. But unfortunately, like I said, it's more widespread than people think. And many times, like she said, people don't realize that they're getting screwed over. You assume that your boss is going to at least be paying you what he said. But it's not happening like all the time.
Thanks for that call, Jill. I don't remember seeing this in your reporting. Is there such a thing as a whistleblower scenario for someone in a position like that sees this kind of wage theft, not just one or two times, but consistently?
Yeah. So first of all, I don't think they call them whistleblowers, but a third party can file a complaint with the Department of Labor and say this is happening. What I don't know is I don't think you can do it anonymously. I'm not sure about that. I would go to the Department of Labor's website because you don't have to be an employee to file the complaint. You could be like a third party or witness to it to file it. I just don't know if you're guaranteed to be anonymous. Like they may end up, if they contact the company, they may have to say where they got the information from.
Thanks again for that call. I appreciate it. Time for one more caller. I think Rena is with us in Franklin. Rena, hello.
Hi. I was a closer for a title company / mortgage company, and I had to go wherever the lender was, and sometimes I would be there until 6 o'clock or later, and we're talking about Cedarburg to Kenosha, way out to Pewaukee and wherever else, but I would come back in to the office or do it the next morning, log on to, what, ADT or one of those, you know, online pay things, and then the boss's secretary, assistant, whatever, would change it so that I wouldn't get the real hours, and it was easy to prove where I had been and for how long. She just didn't think that I should get over 40 hours. So the company went out of business, and I didn't cry. But, I mean, she just, you know, countermanded it. I complained to her. I complained to the president of the company, and nothing ever changed. And then, you know, the company closed its doors, and we were all out of a job. But it was common, just so common for her to steal from us. When
Rena,
really,
I have to jump in because we're just about out of time. But Alexia, I mean, is that, you know, the company moving back the odometer basically on your time clock? Is that a complainable thing that somebody could take to the Labor Department?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That is so common. It's so sad, but that is so common. Like, it's even happened to me when I was an hourly worker at a newspaper. Not where they would change the hours, but where they would say, you know, we're only paying for 40 hours a week, and but they would still expect you to work more than 40 hours a week. So, I mean, it's just such a common scenario.
Rena, sorry that happened to you. Thanks for calling in. And Alexia, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alexia Fernandez-Campbell is a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. She joined us today to talk about her recent investigation on wage theft. Coming up, we'll get a take on a new bill that would make harassing and assaulting referees a misdemeanor in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, how is the conversation about autism changing? Jen White hears more about the momentum to move past campaigns to raise awareness and to focus more on autism acceptance. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a veteran who turned to religious service after his time in the military.
For Yao Yang, inclusion is a guiding principle. He moved to Wisconsin as a child and went on to join the Army National Guard, where he taught fellow U.S. soldiers about Hmong history. After his service, he became a pastor and founded a church in central Wisconsin. Yang shares his experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative. As a warning, some parts of the story describe battleground violence.
My name is Yao Yang. I am 39 years old, and I am talking to you from my house located in Merrill, Wisconsin. Growing up here in central Wisconsin was really challenging. I was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. I came to central Wisconsin when I was 7 years old. Life here in the United States was a little bit better than living in the refugee camps, but by American standards, we were still living in poverty. There was a wonderful lady. Her name was Anne Merrifield, and she was my English as a second language teacher. She, like, understood that our family, we didn't have a whole lot. One winter, right before Christmas break, she had said, "Hey, Yao, why don't you and your family come over to my house for Christmas Day?" We just enjoyed all the festivities of what it meant to celebrate in American Christmas. And for the first time in my life, like, I finally felt like I belong here in the United States. Like, I got this true American experience. She continued to take my family under her wing. The first time going camping was because of her. The first time catching a fish was because of her. She didn't have to do that. as a teacher, but she went out of her way to truly give me this life experience. After I graduated from high school, a year later, September 11th happened. And that event really just profoundly changed me. You know, I just may be one person, but I want to make America safer. I knew that what I wanted to be was an American soldier. And so I needed to graduate boot camp in order to do that. When I was down there, I was the only Hmong soldier. People would come and ask me, hey, are you Chinese? Are you Japanese? And I'm like, no, I am Hmong. And so I would have to give all these people a history lesson about the Hmong people. December of 2004, I was stationed in Samarra, Iraq. And Samarra was so dangerous because the insurgents, they kept on planting IEDs or the improvised explosive devices on roadsides. So as American soldiers, we would sometimes walk by or drive by these areas that we don't even know where the bombs are, and they would detonate these bombs. The most scariest experience of my entire life is just feeling the shockwave of this ginormous IED just going off. And in my desperate measures, I pretty much said to God, God, if you can get me out of Iraq alive, when I come back to Wausau, I'll do whatever you want me to do. It was for me to realize that I'm no longer in control of my life, and I have to turn things over to the Lord. In January of 2016, I started a church called The Cross in my own living room because I didn't have a church building. And so we became multi-ethnic and non-denominational to really try to reach people of all color. I want to be able to tell my kids the reason why Daddy is who he is today is because of the blessings that I have received from all these other people. If there is one thing that I would just love for my kids to be able to learn from me, it is for them to just love all people, regardless of who they are and what they look like.
That was Yao Yang of Merrill, Wisconsin. He shared his experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, a bill in the Wisconsin State Legislature would make it a misdemeanor to harass and abuse referees. Representative Alex Dahlman of Green Lake is co-sponsoring the plan. He told the Assembly Judiciary Committee last month he's been a ref for the past decade and has been verbally and physically confronted while officiating. It's already illegal to assault referees or umpires or anyone, and there are laws against harassment. But Dahlman says officials need protection against harassment and intimidation. His proposal would make that a misdemeanor, and it would carry a maximum penalty of 9 months in jail and a $10,000 fine.
I believe that this bill will take a large step towards deterring the verbal and physical abuse that sports officials are currently experiencing and will allow our youth sport environments to be much more welcoming and create a much more positive environment for them to grow.
Our next guest says the biggest culprits are not usually the players or coaches, but the parents. And it's gotten so bad that fewer people are actually signing up to be refs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this? Have you noticed an increase maybe in bad behavior from fans toward referees, especially in youth sports? If you have reffed games or umpired games, we especially want to hear from you. Have you seen this kind of harassment by parents while officiating? Have you been scared for your safety in some moments? Have you thought about giving it up, or did you give it up? Call in at 800-642-1234. And what do you think about making harassment of officials a misdemeanor? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Barry Mano is the founder and president of the Racine-based National Association of Sports Officials and the founder of Referee Magazine. Barry, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yes, sir, Rob, glad to be with you.
Talk about the problem as you see it with the treatment of referees and what they're being subjected to.
Well, it's never really been worse, frankly, all across the United States. And that is one of the main reasons, the primary reason, lack of sportsmanship, why men and women and young people get out of sports officiating. And so even before the pandemic, we had an issue with not enough warm bodies coming into sports officiating. The pandemic, of course, put an exclamation mark on that. So all across Wisconsin and in many, many states, we're now seeing roughly a 30% decline in registrations for people to go out and referee games at the high school and youth level. That's a very serious problem. And wrapped up in all of that, of course, has been bad behavior, mostly physical assaults against sports officials. That's what we worry about more than anything. The AB 158 here in Wisconsin deals more with verbal assaults and harassment.
Yeah, I think everybody's seen at any kind of sporting event the instant reaction to a call, but it gets way worse than that. Can you tell us, short of the physical attacks on refs, which I assume everybody thinks is a problem, can you talk about the verbal assaults, the intimidation, the harassment that many refs are familiar with?
Well, intimidation is a good word. I mean, and people coming out of the stands, just people following referees into their parking lots, because in many events, certainly at the youth level, you change clothes or put your gear away in the back of your car. You're out in a parking lot. And so there's been so many incidents of continued harassment away from the actual field or the pitch, and in some cases even from the floor. Back in 2017-18, the National Association of Sports Officials did an intensive survey of sports officials, and over 17,000 officials responded to that survey. And out of that survey, here are some of the things that we found. 64% of the officials have removed a spectator from a court or a field for poor behavior. That's 64% of the officials had to remove a spectator. 57% had to step in and break up a fight or a skirmish during a game. 53% of the officials felt unsafe or feared for their safety, and that number goes over 60% for female officials. I think that demonstrates that in the minds and the souls and the hearts of the people who officiate sports, that there's a problem.
With a law like the one that prompted this conversation, are you hoping that apart from, people actually being charged with misdemeanors, just the existence of this law might send a message about what's appropriate on the sidelines?
Well, that's really so important in all of us, in all of this discussion and all these efforts. We've been successful in 22 states to get laws passed regarding assaults against sports officials. 3 weeks ago, I was in front of the Judiciary Committee for the Assembly in Madison. And one of the points that I was making there is, in Wisconsin and in most states, they have what's known as enhanced classes. And that can be nurses, that can be public transit drivers, it can be police, fire, teachers. When we enhance a class, we as a society are saying these individuals have a special and unique importance to our culture and to our society. And that's why I have lobbied long and hard for decades to get sports officials, amateur sports officials, considered to be an enhanced class, to get special protections, that if you do something bad to a sports official when he or she is carrying out their responsibilities, then it is going to cost you more than if you did that same act out on the street to a fellow citizen. And that's why I think that whole aspect's important, because it's a demonstration effect to people about what's important to us. And I dare say, sports seems to be very important to us in American society.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Colin is with us in Wausau. Colin, hi.
Yeah, thank you for talking about this subject, and thank you for taking my call. I used to coach, and I got out of coaching for other reasons, but there was a group of coaches in our conference, and they were very successful, but they were going to walk away because of the parents. And the district made the parents, players, and coaches sit down and look at the four roles of any match. And one is a coach, one is a player, one is a ref, and one is a parent or a fan. And they basically put it in the parents' lap saying, you're not a coach, you're not a player, and you're not a ref. And if you're not going to be the parent, then don't come. And it really kind of put the parents in their places, the players in their places, and even sometimes the coaches in their players are in their places so that they just did the job that they were to do rather than try to do all three or four jobs in that one thing. So I think that could be a tool.
Thanks a lot for the call, Barry. And I've seen that. My kids are athletes. They've been in a couple different clubs. Some set a very strong guideline for parents. Some did not. And it showed up on the sidelines. Do you think there's a need for that, to for districts or leagues or clubs to set those guidelines early and often?
Boy, absolutely, yes. It sets the culture. It sets the tone for what we're going to do. And I should say, this whole issue can't turn on the rightness or the wrongness of calls that referees make. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult undertaking. They're doing their best. They don't care who wins the game. Get over it, folks. We don't care. We're out there trying to be impartial. We're trying to enforce the rules fairly and while emphasizing safety and doing so in a proper manner. That's our job. That's what we want to do. And so when we keep having these intrusions, especially by parents / fans at the lower level games going absolutely crazy. I mean, you know, we've had two or three deaths in this country from fans running out and physically assaulting an official during the game and right after the game, and the officials died. I mean, come on, enough already. We're supposed to be using this as sort of an extension of a classroom. It's an educational opportunity, especially to teach young people, hey, look, guess what? In life, you're probably going to get some calls you don't like. You're probably going to get some calls, by the way, that might be wrong. Technically, part of this is to learn how to pick up the pieces and keep moving. We've lost sight of that fact, and we need to reemphasize that, especially to the young people that play sports.
We're talking about the growing abuse and harassment of referees, especially in youth sports, with Barry Mano, founder and president of the National Association of Sports Officials and founder of Referee Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this on your sidelines if you are an athlete or parent of or coach or an official yourself? What do you think of the proposed idea in Wisconsin to raise some kinds of intimidation and harassment of officials to a full-on misdemeanor? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about abuse and harassment against referees, officials, especially at youth sports games. Advocates say it's a serious problem that's putting officials at risk, and it's driving people out of reffing. A new bill in the state assembly would make referee abuse and harassment a Class A misdemeanor, potentially maximum fines there of $10,000 and 9 months in jail. Barry Mano is our guest, founder and president of the Racine-based National Association of Sports Officials and founder of Referee Magazine. You can join in with your thoughts on this and your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Kylie is with us in Sparta. Kylie, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Kylie?
So what I wanted to say was, I think society kind of is part of the problem as a whole, making this worse. In that we put too much focus on competition with the kids and winning. We focus too much on winning, and when you do that, then that takes away the fun of the game. And we got to get back to letting kids have fun with the game and not focusing on who's going to win, because that hurts the refs. That puts them at danger. They're too focused on winning the game instead of just letting the kids have fun.
Kylie, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Barry?
Well, I've often been quoted that sports is simply life with the volume turned up. So she's dead on point. Why in some measure are we surprised by this when we look around at sort of society in general, at our culture in general? It's louder. It's more brash. We don't cut slack like we used to for other people. We're not as considerate as we used to be. So that all plays out in sports. So she's making a very good point. And by the way, sports officials like it when it's competitive. Those are the kinds of games we want to work. We want to have the one-pointer, as we always said in basketball, versus one that's a 20-pointer, because that challenges us. So we look forward to that challenge. But one of our challenges is we're not getting enough people to come in and become sports officials. I mean, NASO in Racine has set up a website, Say Yes to Officiating, where we provide free to anybody that needs it a lot of material to try to help recruit sports officials. Give you a statistic. If 100 people come into officiating in year one, by the beginning of year four, almost 75 of them have left. There's only 25 that have stayed in. That's not a good thing. And they don't stay in because in that first three and a half years, they realize just how rugged this undertaking is. And then when they're subject to verbal abuse and in some cases physical abuse, they say, what do I need this for? Why would I go out here and take my Saturdays and Sundays and nights and try to do this and contribute to organized sports when this is the result? So we need to come to grips with that as a society. And that's what we're trying to do through AB 158 and in six other states right now that are also considering this type of legislation.
Thanks for the call, Kylie. We'll go to Nick now in Green Bay. Nick, hello.
Hi. My name's Nick from Green Bay. Your guess is absolutely right. I'm a referee. I've been a referee for over 10 years. I referee the sport of lacrosse, which isn't that popular, but I've worked in three states, and I can tell you that, yeah, it's horrible. The level of abuse that we're expected to go through, whether it's a public school, private school, a Catholic school, a youth, high school. I've done a little college club. I'm shocked at what's acceptable on the field, and it makes it really, really difficult to retain officials. I can tell you that in both Georgia and Wisconsin, we've had to cancel games because we don't have enough officials to be able to work the game. So at the end of the day, it's the players and the kids that end up losing out when we lose officials. And absolutely, I can't imagine why it would be anything other than at least a misdemeanor to behave inappropriately towards a referee, just like any other member of society. I don't think we get a pass just because we're on a sports field. Yeah, I think it needs to stop.
Nick, thanks for the call. Barry, no argument from you on that, I imagine.
Boy, Nick gave a really great summary. Can you imagine? I mean, he's been doing this for 10 years. We shouldn't be talking about this kind of stuff. People come in 1 and 2 and 3 years. You ask people who have started officiating, and they end up gravitating, talking just like Nick did. I know Nick loves what he does. I can tell when I'm listening to him. But the thing that he's talking about is this huge negative having to do with how referees are being treated essentially by parents slash fans. Next in line come the coaches, and then every so often we have the players and participants involved in that. But it's really the parents slash fans that are the main problem here, and Nick gave an excellent summary. Unfortunately, he's dead on point.
Time for one more caller. Cyril is with us in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi, Rob. I just wanted to add my support for your guest's task. Both my kids played in youth soccer back in the day, and parents are problem number one and number two. The problem with their youth soccer, a lot of the referees are high school guys or gals who are playing in an advanced league themselves, and so they're easily intimidated by these parents, especially some of the ones who are loud and gross and, you know, vulgar. And so I know,
Cyril, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time, but thanks for calling in, Barry. A lot of the refs themselves are our kids, as my kids were for a while.
Yeah, he was just describing the perfect storm at the youth level. The least skillful players, the least skillful coaches, the least skillful referees in front of the most rabid fans being the parents. That's the perfect storm for what that caller just described.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last few moments, Barry, give some words of encouragement, especially to those parents out there, to maybe be good on the sidelines and police each other a little bit.
Well, you just said it. I mean, the referees are out there trying to ensure the game is played fairly and impartially. Give them that, even though you don't like a call. That doesn't mean the call is wrong. You just don't like it. You have to get extraordinary discipline to make this a good experience for the young people playing organized sports.
Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you, Rob.
Barry Mano is the founder and president of the Racine-based National Association of Sports Officials and the founder of Referee Magazine. We talked to him about a bill in the state legislature that would make harassing and assaulting referees a misdemeanor, could carry a maximum sentence if that happens of 9 months in jail and a $10,000 fine. You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, if you're thinking about leaving on a jet plane, check out the latest news about air travel during the pandemic. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Up next, it's news. Then, President Biden upped his vaccination goal, and there's a growing leadership fight among House Republicans. We'll check it all out in our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.